Hello and welcome to American Dream. I'm your host, Erin Connors, and today we will talk about the American Dream through the eyes of our founding fathers. The United States celebrated its Independence Day holiday this past weekend. So what would the founding fathers think of America today? To help us with this discussion, we have a panel of experts. First, Professor Jim McClellan, the Dean of Humanities and Social Sciences and adjunct professor at George Mason University. Also in our studio is Professor Khalil Jashan of Pepperdine University. Professor Jashan is a lecturer in international studies and a Middle East analyst. Last but certainly not least, on the phone from Chicago, Illinois, is Professor John Mearsheimer, co-director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago. We want to thank you all for joining us today. We really do appreciate it. Well, 4th of July for most people means barbecues and fireworks, but I guess the first big question is, Professor McClellan, have Americans lost the true meaning of this holiday?
Well, unless the true meaning was to buy another Chevrolet, I think they probably missed the point.
Yes.
It was originally, when the Declaration was signed, there was probably much apprehension that it would be meaningless, mm-hmm. because we were still under the grips of what was then the greatest empire in the world, and the thought that we could win that war probably was a dream. So I doubt that they even imagined that there would be a future for the country, that they probably all thought that they would be eventually tried for treason.
And you said we were actually having a little discussion before the show about the Declaration of Independence and how long it took to draft and all about it. It is fascinating, and actually the date is a little off, isn't it?
Yes, actually we celebrate July 4th for some reason, but the document was adopted on July 2nd, and then it was handwritten again so that all the people who had voted to adopt it could sign it, and so the signing took place on the 4th of July, but John Adams, who was one of the signers, wrote to his wife Abigail that July 2nd would be forever celebrated in America as the day that we became independent, and July 2nd, nobody notices. So,
yeah, isn't that something? What do you think about all this?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, always these historical documents that become, if you will, the foundation, particularly a long-term foundation. I mean, nobody knew how long this document is going to be relevant or whether it was going to be relevant at all or not. And there we are, 230-plus years later, and the document remains still central. But at the same time, I think to me what is so striking is the fact that when a document, you know, lasts for a prolonged period of time like this, people tend to look at it in a static way, and yet that's not the case in practice. I mean, as a country, we have been around for, you know, we even, despite the fact that we continue to describe ourselves as a relatively new nation, and act as such sometimes, yet, you know, this document has been in force for more than 233 years, and a lot of changes have taken place. So even though the document has remained constant, and the same thing applies, I think, for the Constitution, which is definitely more constant and more enforced, but we have changed as a nation, and when we look at different periods in our history, we see change of focus, we see change of policy. Mm-hmm. Are we today as committed to liberty? Do we grant other nations the same concept and measure of liberty that we granted ourselves versus the British Crown that we read in the Declaration of Independence? So there are a lot of questions that one, you know, has to ponder when you think about a prolonged history like 230-plus years.
Professor Mearsheimer, jump right in. Some of your initial thoughts.
You know, just to build on what Khalil said, I think the fact that the Declaration has been around for over 230 years means that most Americans pretty much take it for granted that we're here to stay. And the whole notion that our independence was somewhat tenuous in 1776 is not an idea that resonates with people. My argument would be that the reason that the Declaration and this particular holiday is so important is because the United States is an immigrant culture, and it's very important to assimilate immigrants into the American way of life. Excuse me. And we have all these symbols and all these institutions and ways of doing that. And I think that the 4th of July is very important for bringing out to most people what it means to be an American. And I think it goes a long way towards helping turn this country into a melting pot, which I think is one of its greatest virtues.
And the songs and the fireworks and everything help to make people feel a little more patriotic, I suppose.
That can sometimes be a bad thing, as we all know, but it also can be a good thing, because it is important to make sure that everybody who comes to this country feels that they're part of the mainstream and indeed becomes part of the mainstream. And we're really terrific as a country at doing that. Most other countries around the world, if you're an immigrant, you're not accepted for the most part. But that's very different here. And I think the 4th of July plays a key role in that.
Well, sure, absolutely.
I think
please.
This point is very, very important in that John just made, in the sense that we are a nation of immigrants, mm-hmm. and this tends to be one of those the highlights of kind of like our unifying, if you will, social behaviors that are not very frequent in the sense that American society, unlike foreign countries, quote unquote, or third world countries, do not have a strong and steady display of nationalism, if you will, that is seen almost on a daily basis in developing countries. It's not seen in this country. We're kind of a bit withdrawn from that type of behavior. So occasionally, this type of a unifying, if you will, celebration, mm-hmm. Whereby the immigrant who just landed here celebrates as equally and as emotionally as the person whose ancestors came on the Mayflower, shows the miracle of, I think, this system and this this country, which is hard to understand. Those of us who come from other cultures and other background and are ourselves first-generation immigrants, because, frankly, many societies are not immigrant societies. And, you know, what John mentioned, that we are a culture of immigration, mm-hmm. most people in other cultures don't understand that. I mean, you can move from one location to another, let's say in the Middle East, where I come from. You can work there for generations. Maybe even your grandparents would move, and you're born there, but you never belong. You're never seen as, even your last name is changed to reflect your point of origin, in the sense that this new location will not accept you the way the United States is accepting of its immigrants. And this is something that is kind of unique. I mean, those of us who travel back and forth, we go to our land of origin. People kind of talk to us, particularly if we maintain the language and maintain the culture, and they don't understand when you refer to yourself as Americans, and they say, what are you talking about? You were born here. And say, yeah, but I also immigrated from mm-hmm. from here. So that notion of immigration and belonging that we tend to celebrate, a part of the, inherently part of the celebration on July 4th, is not fully understood overseas, and you can't have enough explanation to really convince people that actually you can change when you go to the States, mm-hmm. Choose to immigrate to the States. You own a piece of the rock here, you know.
That's right, Professor.
We are a Mongol nation. There's no question about that. And if I checked my ancestry back, I think I have somebody on the Mayflower, but I have somebody who was a Comanche on the Great Plains, and I have people from Europe. From all different nations. If I were to try to identify myself as anything but an American, it would be impossible because of this Mongol background. But the nice thing about this culture is that when people come here, they bring with them things from the old world. So I eat falafels on a regular basis, and I eat tacos on a regular basis, and I eat pizza, and I eat Chinese food, because they're all now a part of American culture.
It's the big melting pot.
It is the melting pot. We've mixed all those people and all those foods together.
And that's a wonderful thing. Well, one of the most famous lines in the Declaration of Independence that most people tend to remember is, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Professor Mearsheimer, are Americans getting that? Do they understand? Are they getting the life, liberty, pursuit of happiness?
Well, it's very important to understand that when the country was first created, there was a huge chunk of the population that was not given those rights by any means. In fact, they were enslaved. So this was an imperfect union at the beginning. But fortunately, with the passage of time, certainly with the Civil War and then the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act in the mid-1960s, and now with President Obama, what we've seen is that we've made huge strides forward in terms of integrating the black population into the American mainstream. And we've also become very adept at integrating immigrants into the United States. Most people don't realize this, but the first large group of immigrants to come into the United States were Irish and German Americans starting in the early 1800s. And those Irish Americans were discriminated against viciously by the people who ran the country at the time, who were basically white Anglo-Saxon Protestants who had no love whatsoever for the Irish. But with the passage of time, we've just gotten much better at integrating what we call hyphenated Americans into the American mainstream. So America is, I think, at this point in time, a country where, you know, liberty and justice and the good life are held out to most people. And this is a wonderful thing. This is not to say we can't improve on a lot of what we do, but we're a lot better off today than we were in 1776, especially because of the slavery issue.
Now, Professor McClellan, unalienable rights, are those God-given? What is that?
Well, I think the founding fathers were not quite as religious as many of the fundamentalists in this country are today. They were normally deists. They believed that there probably was some creator, but they weren't sure what that might be or what form it would take. Or certainly organized religion was not something that they were particularly fond of, particularly people like Jefferson. But I think that they based a lot of this on that they're trying to overthrow a monarch. And so the idea was that power came from the monarchy down, and they wanted to find some other base that might be a source of power that would be something that would liberate the people themselves. So the God-given part, I think, is probably something they threw in there to find some justification. But I think they believe that human rights are fundamental, that they don't come from anything except from being human.
Now, you said that word changed a little bit.
And there were several versions of the Declaration written, because this was before the printing press was actually employed. It's written in longhand, as you know. We use printing press for newspapers, but this was written in longhand, and they wrote out several editions of this so that each state, which had become a state with this document, because they were colonies before that, would have a copy of this document. And when it was copied over, in some of the documents it says unalienable, others it says inalienable. But I think the point is the same, that these are rights that can't be given up. They are fundamental to human nature. And the point about this this paragraph in which that resides is probably the most revolutionary paragraph in American history. And if you look at the American Revolution, what we call the American Revolution, it really wasn't a revolution. It was a war of independence. And we were the first to break away from the colonial rule of Europe. We set the trend that's still being followed across the world as nations set themselves free from colonial bondage. So that was over in 1783 with the treaty. Mm-hmm. But the Declaration itself was the revolution and is the revolution. And trying to implement the ideas of that document, that all men are created equal, that they have these inalienable rights, that they have a right to abolish government when these rights are not granted to them, and create a government that is of their liking. And that phrase, you didn't get to it yet in there, but there's a phrase in there that says while they have this right to dissolve and abolish governments that are oppressive, they then have a right to create a government that is, in their way of thinking, protective of their safety and happiness. And one of the flaws that has been through our history is that while we have embraced these ideals and we've wanted to share them with the world, that part about letting other people decide for themselves what gives them safety and happiness has been a fault of our foreign policy for the last 60 years or so. We've deemed that we knew better than others how their government should be.
What about the American dream? I'm sure that the founding fathers had a dream of what America will be like and what people will have. Is it the house, the car, the white picket fence? Or, you know, so many people are going through such hard times right now.
Right. Well, I'm not sure the American dream was as materialistic as we define it today, because our whole culture has changed and has emerged into more materialistic terms, the way we define it today. But certainly, I think for the founding fathers who came essentially from Europe in the initial phase and were concerned about what experience they had in Europe and the initial phase of American history itself, the continued oppressive control by Europeans here. So the dream, I think, continued to focus more on liberty, more on the worthiness of the human, the factor more on the worthiness of individuals, more than on materialistic achievements the way it is today, where we define, the American dream as you come from anywhere in the world, regardless of your background, regardless of your stature, regardless of your education, and you become part of us and you achieve the ultimate richness that this country offers you, mostly in terms of materialism. And that's why occasionally the American dream runs into problems, particularly at this stage where our economy is suffering from an implosion, not only our economy, actually the world's economy. And it has impacted us and definitely impacts the American dream. And that's when I think we kind of get dislocated as Americans, because after all, the American dream has become so sacrosanct for so many of us,
right,
as if it's a basic right that we have as Americans. And when an impediment stands in the way between us and that dream, the way we define it today, we kind of get somehow a little bit uncomfortable and maybe even cynical about where we came from as a political system and what was the original intent of that dream.
Professor Mearsheimer, your thoughts?
I agree with everything that's been said. I don't have much to add on this particular point.
What about, feel free.
I think it's the American dream is the idea that anybody who's willing to come here and work hard can rise up, and that your children will have a higher status in society than you do because you can give them that push up the ladder. And it's the idea of a classless society. When the Europeans settled here, Europe was stratified. Mm-hmm. And if you were born into a working class or a peasant class, you never expected to rise above that. But I think the frontier here was a leveling agent, that when people came here, noble blood was less important than your skills. Mm-hmm. And skills were highly valued, more so than nobility. And so people who had those skills were able to rise up. And because we had this vast territory to expand into with an abundance of resources found nowhere else on the planet, there were great opportunities for people to continue to move into the into the middle class and above, and to break through what would have been stratified in other mm-hmm. countries. But this upward mobility gave people the idea that, yes, hard work and education can succeed. Going back to that phrase again about all people being created equal, that everybody's going to have an equal opportunity. Maybe they're not equal in skills, maybe they're not equal in educational background, but everybody gets to start at the same line and do what they can do.
And Professor Mearsheimer, what about health care? You know, President Obama wants to make it available to everybody in some way. Do you think that should be an unalienable right?
Well, I think if we can work out a system where we can provide health care to everybody, that would be a wonderful thing. I'm not sure it should be an inalienable right in the sense that the Founding Fathers were talking about inalienable rights, but I think that most Americans would agree that at this point in time we need a system that covers everybody. So I think it makes eminently good sense.
I'd like to comment on your earlier question, whether that the statement from the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal, and the issue also the concept of inalienable rights, whether that is still self-evident. Mm-hmm. Again, what I said earlier in the program, in terms of when you deal with these issues on a protracted basis, history tends to distort these concepts. They do not stay steady or constant all the time in terms of how we interpret them or how we practice them. I'm not sure that some of these concepts, at least the way that we attribute them to the Founding Father in terms of their original intent, are as self-evident today to all of us. They might be as self-evident to many of us, they might be as self-evident to most of us, but I'm not sure they are always as to everybody. Attribute that in addition to the passage of time and the fact that we react to mm-hmm. new environments, to new phases in history that we go through as a nation. But there are two things that have impacted that, I believe, historically. One is the fact that these concepts have been politicized over time. So when you talk about all men are created equal, at one point, it depends who we included in all men.
Mm-hmm.
Did we include women? Did we include men of color? Did we include third world countries. And so that has this has been a developing concept, if you will, in our practice. The same thing applies to kind of how also our terminology in terms of these basic documents, historical documents of American history, have been interpreted is the issue of our kind of American exceptionalism. Mm-hmm. The fact that throughout our history we've had phases of somehow looking at these rights, the way we define them and the way we acquire them and the way we maintain them, as mainly unique to us. Mm-hmm. And quite often we kind of departed from the fact when we talked about in the early phase, I think maybe the founding fathers were a little bit more broader in their definition of these terms than some of us are today in terms of who's entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, even though that was not born in, as John mentioned earlier, was not born in a perfect society at the mm-hmm. time, and we have developed since then and have become better at dealing with immigrants, at dealing with minorities, and so on.
Do you think the founding fathers would have ever expected there would be an African American taking the highest office in the nation?
I think so, but whether they would have anticipated it soon, I doubt it. But when they made these statements, I'm sure they probably had in mind that it wasn't necessarily a WASP that will continue to occupy that office.
Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Can I just jump in?
I'm sorry. Let's get Professor Mearsheimer in here.
I think it's important to remember that the founding fathers not only did not agree among themselves on most issues, but they disagreed quite violently. And I recently read a biography of Alexander Hamilton, and Hamilton and Jefferson were bitter foes. And in fact, Hamilton was killed in a duel by Aaron Burr, who was then the Vice President of the United States. So even though these individuals agreed on a handful of broad principles that we all agree on, when you tried to operationalize those principles, put them into practice, there were quite severe disagreements among the founding fathers, and the politics of the time were every bit as bitter as the politics of contemporary America.
Before we go to break.
Yeah, this point was important because what the Declaration does is it gives us a fundamental premise from which we can all argue. And so it's been an evolving idea. I would not try to bind people 10 generations from now to what I think today. But I have these basic principles that I hope will continue, the idea of equality and opportunity and liberty. And within the context of those times, I think they should be able to define what they want. Just as he points out, in the time of the Founding Fathers, they had this fundamental agreement. But beyond that, what did it mean?
All right. Well, we're going to get to a lot more issues right after the break on American Dream. Professor Mearsheimer, I know you can't stay with us for the whole hour, so we do appreciate you taking some time to join us today.
My pleasure.
All right. There's more American Dream straight ahead. Stay with us.